surprised in the middle of the broadcast when a work crew began literally ripping the roof off of KFJC, and it was so loud that I could literally not hear the signal much of the time coming through my headphones unless I cranked it all the way up. And during that rather interesting phone-in session, at one point we were talking about the Bush campaign, and I identified a fellow who used to be the manager of Bush's campaign, namely a guy named Fred Malek, M-A-L-E-K, who had been commissioned by the Nixon White House to draw up a list of all of the Jews on the Bureau of, in the Bureau of Labor Statistics, because Richard Nixon had become convinced that the high unemployment figures that were being released were due to a Jewish conspiracy against him in the Bureau of Labor Statistics. He then commissioned Fred Malek to clean house, so to speak. Malek had been the top dog in charge of the Bush campaign until, of course, former Secretary of State James Baker took over, but under the stress of the situation, basically, it sounded sort of like the attack on Pearl Harbor in here. I made that mistake, identifying the former top dog of the Bush campaign as the present top dog. He is no longer top dog, but merely another one of the dogs in the pound. Also, a few weeks ago, I cited an excellent book about the Falange, the Spanish fascist group begun by members of the German General Staff, particularly Wilhelm von Vopel, or supported by the German General Staff, particularly Wilhelm von Vopel. And the author of that book was not Alan Hind. It was Alan Chase. Okay, I double-checked, and I was incorrect in recalling the author's last name. So do take note of those corrections. Now, I'm going to give you a rundown of what it is we're going to be listening to on the prepared during the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast. And again, be ready to go up till midnight tonight, because I think this will probably run over 11 o'clock, and I do have permission to go up till midnight. This is another installment of Radio Free America program number 37, a massive, massive archive show called How the United States Lost the Second World War. This evening, we're going to be covering events in Germany, and then going, in a sense, we're going to cover some events in Germany, review a lot of material to gain background, and then we're going to swing back over to this side of the Atlantic. And next week, we're going to bring things right up to the present and launch right back into current events. This is the underpinning for much of what is going on. Next week, we're going to be covering, we will move right back into the present. This evening, I will be reviewing things covered in previous broadcasts, plus some new material, in order to sort of give people the right perspective on what forces underlie some of the things that we've spoken about in the past. We're going to begin by taking a look at the origins of the German General Staff basically the makeup of the German National Security Establishment in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. This by way of examining the nature of the National Security Establishment, which was heavily involved with our own and which wielded a profound influence on the development of our own National Security Establishment and on the history of the Cold War. We're going to begin by taking a look at Admiral von Dönitz's farewell address to the German General Staff. Von Dönitz succeeded Adolf Hitler very briefly, and we're going to take a look at what he had to say to the General Staff in his farewell address. Basically, he said, keep your chin up, we're going to hook up with the Western powers in order to regain our lost territories. This before the actual conclusion of World War II, a rather prophetic statement. After that, we're going to review also the view of Reinhard Gehlen, the Nazi Eastern Front spy chief, who jumped to the Central Intelligence Agency at the end of the war with, for all intents and purposes, his entire organization intact. Gehlen also, before the end of World War II, looked to the alliance, an alliance, with the Western powers against communism as a means for regaining Germany's lost territories. Bear in mind throughout this two of the underlying principles of Radio Free America number 37, namely the strategic use of anti-communism by the Germans as a vehicle for conquest, and also the Christian West concept, which is the concept underlying NATO. Basically, the Third Reich sought to go underground by having a Hitlerless Reich join up with the Western powers in an anti-Soviet alliance. The Third Reich wanted to do that during the war. That was not possible due to the military situation, but it is pretty apparent that that's basically the underlying concept of NATO, and after the conclusion of hostilities, that goal was realized. We're going to take a look at Reinhard Galen, rather, and his, but this by way of review, and his submitting his program of cooperation with the United States to Admiral von Dönitz for his approval. This indicating, as author Carl Oglesby appropriately notes, that the German chain of command was still in effect even after the end of World War II and the formal dissolution of the Third Reich and the German General Staff. We're also going to review a principle of Galen's agreement with the United States, namely, that when German and American interests conflicted, it was understood that the Galen Organization would support German over American interests, a very, very important consideration under the circumstances. After that, we're going to take a look at the reformation of the German General Staff. Now, there are three things that will form sort of a triad that we're going to be looking at through much of the broadcast this evening. For the last 2 weeks, we have focused on something that will seem like fiction to the uninitiated observer, but which unfortunately is only too true and well-documented if you know where to look for the documentation, namely that the Nazi Party of Germany did not vanish, but rather went underground and continued to function in a very effective and cohesive fashion from exile in Madrid, Spain, or in the Spain of Francisco Franco, himself an ardent fascist who had been supported by Hitler and Mussolini during the Spanish Civil War. Now, this Nazi Party in exile had basically attempted an open coup in 1953 in the quote new unquote Germany. The main figure in that coup was Dr. Werner Naumann, N-A-U-M-A-N-N, the former Secretary of State in Joseph Goebbels' propaganda ministry, and the individual named in Hitler's will to succeed Joseph Goebbels. Naumann and his fellow coup plotters were not only representatives of and deeply connected to this Nazi Party in exile in Madrid, but wielded a profound influence over the Adenauer government and over all of Germany from exile, because as we have seen in the last several weeks, the denazification of Germany was in fact a myth. It was never denazified, as incredible as that may seem to, again, the uninitiated observer. I want to reiterate, this is not in any way to imply that there are not many democratically minded Germans there are, but rather that the institutions, the courts, the government, the civil service, and as we shall see this evening, well, the political leadership and the national security establishment, as well as the corporations that supported Adolf Hitler, were put right back into power. Now, we're going to take a look at the interrelationship this evening between the Nazi Party in exile, in particular the coup plotters around Werner Naumann, the Adenauer government and the succeeding governments in Germany, and the policies pursued by that Germany, in particular its national security establishment. So again, bear in mind Dr. Werner Naumann, bear in mind the Nazi Party in exile, forecast accurately by Kurt Ries in his book The Nazis Go Underground in 1944, and with chilling, depressing documentation presented in the book The New Germany and the Old Nazis by T.H. Tettens. And we're going to refer to that book again this evening. But take note of the Naumann coup plotters, the Madrid government exile. Take note of the way the German government has functioned in conjunction with that, and the way it has basically corresponded to the wishes and commands of that Nazi Party in exile, and in turn, the policies pursued by the national security establishment of the new Germany will be seen to fall directly in line with the desires and the commands of that Nazi Party in exile. I realize that this will sound like, quote, Buck Rogers stuff, unquote, to quote a radio play from 1944 that I played earlier in this series, several months ago, in fact. But unfortunately, these things are only too well documented if you know where to look for it, and that's why I'm taking the time to set this out for you. We're going to begin by taking a look at the role of Werner Naumann acting on behalf of the Nazi Party in exile in reviving the German General Staff. We're going to begin by taking a look at something called the Bruderschaft, Brüderschaft, which was an organization of former German military men, in particular general staff officers and SS men, which functioned as a support network, an underground military organization in American POW camps almost from the time of the German surrender. We're going to take a look after that at how the growing tensions of the Cold War, and recall how those were fed by the profound disinformation given by the Galen Organization to the United States, we're going to take a look at how the growing Cold War tensions led to the remilitarization of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany, and the reinstitution of many of the people who had led Hitler's armed forces. Bear in mind, again, the principle of anti-communism as a vehicle for conquest, fear of communism as a vehicle for conquest. It is something that the Nazi Party and Germany learned right after World War I, and it's something that they utilized very effectively throughout the Second World War and after World War II. It is one of the underlying principles of this entire broadcast. The Korean War had much to do with the remilitarization of Germany, and we're going to take a look at that. We're also going to take a look at the role of Werner Naumann and the forces behind him, the Ruhr industrialists, as well as that Nazi party in exile in Madrid, in forming German veterans organizations, which in turn paved the way for the remilitarization of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany to take its place in NATO, and in particular, to take its place as the keystone of the Christian West concept. Again, a Third Reich plan for surviving the military defeat of World War II that became the seed for NATO. Following that, we're going to take a look at how the German General Staff was rebuilt after World War II, again, including many of the same individuals. We're going to begin by taking a look at how the German General Staff was rebuilt after World War I. Specifically, we're going to take a look at the miniaturization program of German Chief of Staff, Head of the General Staff, Hans von Seeckt. That's S-E-E-C-K-T. One of the things that enabled Germany to remilitarize so quickly under Adolf Hitler was that the small German army that was allowed by the Treaty of Versailles was trained in such a way as every person in that army had the training of a general staff officer, so that when Hitler chose to expand the German army, he was able to do so very quickly because people far down the chain of command had been trained to assume a command several pay grades above them. Basically, everybody in the German, all of the key people in the German army under Hans von Seeckt, which was limited to a very small number of troops, were in fact trained to become officers when the need arose. This permitted the rapid expansion of the German army before World War II. We're going to take a look at this miniaturization program under Hans von Seeckt, and in particular we're going to take a look at an officer named Adolf Heusinger, H-E-U-S-I-N-G-E-R, and we're going to take a look at his inclusion in the Truppengeneralstab of Hans von Seeckt. General Heusinger went on to become the Chief of Operations and Planning for OKH, Oberkommando der Heere. Basically, he was in charge of all Third Reich land forces during World War II and was one of the principal generals in Hitler's army. He had been one of the people trained by Hans von Seeckt. And what we're going to look at in the first part of the program this evening is how the Galen Spy Organization, something that we have looked at great length over the many years on this program, how the Galen Spy Organization in some ways functioned in post-World War II Germany in a manner analogous to the miniaturization program and the Truppengeneralstab under Hans von Seeckt. We're going to take a look at the evolution of the career, the post-World War II career of General Adolf Heusinger, again one of the top military leaders under Adolf Hitler, in charge of operations and planning for the Oberkommando der Heere, planned every Third Reich military campaign from 1940 on, including the invasion of the Soviet Union. And Heusinger, in that position, was directly responsible for the operations of the Einsatzgruppen. Those were the mobile killing squads which followed the frontline German troops into the Soviet Union and were responsible for the liquidation of millions of people. And again, that those were under Heusinger's command. However, that did not in any way impede the post-World War II career of Adolf Heusinger. What we're going to take a look at in examining Heusinger's the evolution of Heusinger's post-World War II career is how he was able to move up. Initially, we seem to be missing some information here. No. In any event, what we're going to take a look at this evening is how Heusinger moved up in the post-World War II period, and we're going to take a look at the evolution of his career. Oh, no, wait a minute, hold it. Everything is just fine. I thought I had mislaid some information, but even though the best-laid plans of mice and men gang off to glay, I have my expletive deleted together, so not here, folks. Just a little temporary confusion. In any event, after taking a look at Heusinger's role in supervising the Einsatzgruppen, we're going to take a look at how Heusinger was able to evolve in the post-World War II period. Even though Heusinger himself was a war criminal, he had tremendous expertise about the Soviet Union, so he quickly became an honored personality, so to speak, and was eliminated from the war crimes, the list of war criminals, I should say, by the Allies for that reason. Well, being a Soviet, quote, expert, unquote, led to Adolf Heusinger working for, you guessed it, the Galen Organization after World War II. And what we're going to look at is how, while working for the Galen Organization, again, the Nazi Eastern Front Intelligence Organization, Fremde Heere Ost, which jumped to the CIA, became the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and ultimately it became the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the West German Intelligence Service, while continuing to supply the U.S. and NATO with a vast bulk of their intelligence on the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. And Heusinger used his situation with the Galen organization to put together the new German General Staff, and not surprisingly, Heusinger selected people who were key members of the General Staff under Adolf Hitler. We're then going to review a piece of information that we looked at before and that we will touch back on later in the broadcast this evening, namely that the Galen Organization was directly responsible for placing most of the people who rose to positions of power in the new defense ministry. Again, I'm not suggesting this is an exact analogy, but it is, I think, an appropriate comparison. Again, comparing the miniaturization program in the Truppengeneralstab of Hans von Seeckt after World War I with the Galen Organization after World War II, because the spawning of the, quote, new, unquote, German General Staff came with the Galen Organization. Take note here of a fellow named Franz Josef Strauss, the defense minister of the first defense minister of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. He was an individual who was of extremely reactionary political views and an individual who was hooked up with Paul Weyrich of the Free Congress Foundation. We've touched on that before, and we're going to come back to that later. Finally, we're going to take a look at the ultimate evolution of Adolf Heusinger's career, and we're going to take a look at how President Kennedy, in a move that was to haunt him very badly later, President Kennedy installed Adolf Heusinger, who, by the way, Heusinger went on to become the Inspector General of all of the German armed forces. That's the equivalent of the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He rose to the position, the highest position of leadership on the German General Staff, but the upward elevator, the up elevator, did not stop there for Adolf Heusinger. On, appropriately enough, April Fool's Day of 1961, President Kennedy, who'd been in office, less than 3 months, installed Adolf Heusinger as the head of the Permanent Military Committee of NATO, the chairman of the Permanent Military Committee of NATO. This made Adolf Heusinger the top-ranking military officer in NATO. It gave him a profound role in deciding military policy for NATO. And Kennedy also broke with tradition and made NATO a fourth nuclear power. This had previously been contrary to U.S. policy, and the U.S. had avoided it. Kennedy broke with that tradition and installed as the head of NATO, now a fourth nuclear power, was none other than Adolf Heusinger, Adolf Ernst Heusinger, the head, person who was chief of operations and planning for the Oberkommando der Heere, in charge of all land forces of Hitler's army for all intents and purposes. And it should be noted that Adolf Heusinger was then installed in the Pentagon. He had his own suite of offices in the Pentagon and was on the same level of command as the highest-ranking U.S. military officers. So again, fear of communism, anti-communism, became a very effective vehicle for conquest, and Adolf Heusinger ultimately was able to utilize that to rise to a very, very high place within NATO. One can only imagine the effect that must have had on the former Soviet Union. It certainly must have greatly aggravated tensions and the arms race. In December of 1961, the Soviets attempted to prevail on NATO in what must have certainly been a propaganda move, but they charged Heusinger with war crimes and tried to have him extradited to the former Soviet Union. It's interesting to see how the United States reacted when the Soviets did this. They simply charged that this was a propaganda exercise, and that anyone who defamed Adolf Heusinger was simply corresponding to or acting on behalf of communist-inspired propaganda to sabotage NATO. Again, bear in mind, one of the central principles of this long archive show, anti-communism as a vehicle for conquest. We're then going to take a look at, we're not going to take a look at anything next, actually. We're going to play a tape. We're going to review a section from Radio Free America program number 14 about the career of Theodor Oberländer, a former SS officer, a key Galen operative during the Second World War, and an individual who not only became the ex-Belé minister under the Adenauer government for a number of years, but an individual who had played a prominent role in setting the Ostpolitik for the Third Reich, and an individual who went on to become a very influential figure, as I said, in the Adenauer government. He was later dismissed because he had presided over the extermination of 7,000 Jews in the city of Lvov, as it was called in the Ukraine, or Lemberg. He was never convicted of that crime. We're going to take a look at how he got out of that. But Theodor Oberländer became a very important functionary with what eventually became the World Anti-Communist League, and was hooked up with some of the reactionary political forces in the United States, which figured in or around the assassination of John Kennedy. We've looked at Oberländer before, but where we're going to examine this evening is where Oberländer fit into in the picture of the Third Reich's national security establishment. After reviewing a section from Radio Free America 14 about Oberländer, we're going to take a look at how Oberländer got off from the charges brought against him for war crimes. Basically, Oberländer was head of the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall, and that was composed of Ukrainian fascists associated with the OUN B group of Stefan Bandera. And all of the witnesses, some 150 former Soviet citizens who testified that, in fact, Theodor Oberländer had nothing to do with any war crimes in Lvov or Lemberg in the period in question, all of those people were affiliated with the OUNB. This from the book Inside the League by John Lee and Scott Anderson. And by way of taking a look at yet another example of the foxes being chosen to mind the hen house, foul play if ever there was. We're then going to take a look at some information which will be setting the discussion concerning the evolution of liberation theory in its context. I'm going to reread some information, some of which was in Radio Free America program number 2, some of which was in Radio Free America number 11, and some of which you have not heard before. We're going to take a look at the ex-Belé organizations. Basically, we're going to take a look at the Landsmannschaften, as they were called in Germany. The so-called ex-Belé, basically, were people of German extraction who had lived in some of the countries to Germany's east, who had enthusiastically collaborated with the Third Reich, and who then were expelled to Germany after the Soviet armies rolled up the Wehrmacht on the Eastern Front, and this in accordance with the agreements at Yalta and Potsdam. We're going to take a look at the ex-Belé, their role in the political policies of the new, quote, new, unquote, Germany, in the national security policies of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany, and we're going to take a look at the evolution of liberation or rollback theory in a different perspective. We're going to begin again by looking at information from the book The Old Nazis in the New Germany, or The New Germany and the Old Nazis, I should say, by T.H. Tettens. And what we're going to be looking at concerns, first of all, the activities of the Volksdeutsche during World War II. We're not going to look at all of their activities, but we will take a look at how they enthusiastically collaborated with the Third Reich, including participation in numerous war crimes. After that, we're going to take a look at how the Naumann organization and the Nazi Party in Exile in Madrid saw the XBLA and their potential value for the Third Reich. They were seen as, Third Reich in Exile, I should say, for the Fourth Reich, perhaps. We are going to take a look at how the Naumann government saw the XBLA as a vehicle for the restoration of German power. And after that, we're going to take a look at the policies of the Adenauer government vis-a-vis the XBLA. Specifically, we're going to take a look at a new term for liberation or rollback theory. That word is Befreiung, B-E-F-R-E-I-U-N-G, the German word for liberation. And we're going to take a look at what liberation meant for the Adenauer government as well as for the Naumann group, the representatives of the Nazi Party in Exile. The XBLA served as a pretext for the Adenauer government to not only avoid diplomatic recognition of many of the countries of Eastern Europe, but also to push for a revision of Germany's borders. Ultimately, the Adenauer government was pushing for the liberation, quote-unquote, of a period, of a stretch of territory going up to the Ural Mountains. And as a result of the adoption of liberation or rollback theory in the United States, and its adoption, first of all, as a national security policy, and ultimately it became a dominant political force in the United States, recall that liberation theory had begun as a Third Reich psychological and political warfare tactic for Eastern Europe. It evolved into a similar strategic concept for the United States, and as a result of the Crusade for Freedoms campaign in the United States, it became ultimately a dominant element of American political life. We're going to be looking at what liberation meant for the German political and national security establishments, which were inextricably linked with ours, and which, through the Galen Organization and its projection into American political life, as well as the projection of liberation theory into American political life as a result of the Crusade for Freedom, we're going to take a look at what the German government meant by liberation. This by way of helping us understand the extent to which the United States ultimately was used in a manner consistent with the way that had been projected by both von Dönitz and Galen before the end of the war. The U.S. ultimately was used as a vehicle for the reconquest, economically, not politically, obviously, of Germany's lost territories and certainly the reoccupation of what used to be East Germany. We're going to take a look also, in addition to taking a look at the Adenauer government and Befreiung, and by the way, the statements that you're going to be seeing here were being issued by the Adenauer government in the same time period that rollback or liberation theory was evolving into a dominant element of American political thinking as well as national security policy. After examining the Adenauer government per se, we're going to look at another Third Reich alumnus. This is a fellow named Dr. Walter Becker, B-E-C-H-E-R. Dr. Becker had been a member of the Nazi Party in a brown shirt. He became one of the top individuals in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany involved with the XBLA organizations. Now, the significance of Becker is that he was able to garner an incredible amount of support in the United States for the XBLA movement, and many people in Germany credited the survival of the XBLA movement in Germany to the profound influence of Dr. Walter Becker with key American politicians, ranging from congressmen to senators, and we're going to read some of those senators, American generals, elements of the political far right in this country enthusiastically supported Dr. Walter Becker and his claims on behalf of the XBLA organizations. Becker began functioning in a very effective way in conjunction with people like Joseph McCarthy, the former senator from Wisconsin, and others, functioning very effectively in the United States. He ultimately appointed a full-time representative in Washington, D.C., a fellow named Richard Sallet, S-A-L-L-E-T. Sallet had been a diplomat for the Third Reich under Goebbels and von Ribbentrop, and it had been involved. It was a quote, American expert unquote. He had been involved in promoting large-scale anti-American activities in the United States against Franklin Roosevelt. He was installed by Walter Becker as a permanent representative in Washington, D.C., and furthered the hitherto very effective work of Dr. Walter Becker. We're going to take a look at the enormous distribution given to the work of Dr. Walter Becker. At one point in the United States, his views were being presented by over 70 newspapers and upwards of 30 million listeners on the Mutual Radio Network. Again, this is a Third Reich alumnus lobbying on behalf of enthusiastic participants in the Third Reich, and we're going to take a look at the massive distribution of Dr. Walter Becker's views in the United States through the activities of media and key American political figures. And again, this is by way of taking a look at the influence of the Third Reich of the quote new unquote Germany on American policy at the same time, in the same time period that liberation theory was becoming a dominant element in American thinking. We have representatives from the Third Reich involved to an enormous degree with major American political figures in promoting the concept of Befreiung or liberation. We've touched on some of this material before, but in examining the evolution of rollback or liberation theory from a Third Reich psychological and political warfare tactic to a dominant element of American strategic and political thinking, it's worth taking a look at the very profound involvement of people, Third Reich alumni, that were included in the political structure and the national security establishments of the quote new unquote Germany, and how they were able to function in conjunction with the American political and national security structure. And to a very real extent, the U.S. ultimately became a tool for these residual Third Reich elements and the goals envisioned by von Dönitz and Galen before the end of World War II were ultimately realized, and the Christian West concept worked out over a period of decades in a way that must have been very gratifying for the people in the Third Reich that had been involved with the planning to go underground. Next, we're going to take a look at the evolution of the Deutsche Soldatenzeitung, or as we came to see it in an earlier installment, the Deutsche Nationalzeitung und Soldatenzeitung. That was the newspaper of Gerhard Frey. It was to that newspaper that Major General Edwin Walker, or former General Edwin Walker, first reported the spurious information that Lee Harvey Oswald had shot at him in April of 1963. We're going to take a look at the evolution of that paper. First of all, we're going to take a look at the strong connections between the people that began that newspaper and the Naumann Group. Again, this group of plotters who were directly connected not only to the Nazi Party in exile in Madrid, but who also exerted a profound influence on the Adenauer government. The Deutsche Soldatenzeitung, later the Deutsche Nationalzeitung und Soldatenzeitung, was begun by people very closely connected to the Naumann government. Key SS officers and former high-ranking Third Reich officials were the founders of this organization. It received funding from the Bonn Press Office. It was actually funded by the Adenauer government, and it also had profound connections with the defense ministry of the quote new unquote Germany. And again, bear in mind the triad that I spoke of earlier: the Naumann Group, representative of the Nazi Party in exile in Madrid, the Adenauer government and succeeding governments, and the national security establishment of the quote new unquote Germany, because the Deutsche Nationalzeitung und Soldatenzeitung represents a manifestation of that triad. Following that, we're going to take a look at a book called The New Nazis of Germany by New Wellington Long, and we're going to learn more about the evolution of the Deutsche Nationalzeitung und Soldatenzeitung. We're going to take a look at some more of the key SS people involved with the founding of that paper. We're going to take a look at how Gerhard Frey changed the paper when he took it over. And we're going to take a look at one of the key writers, one of the, quote, American, unquote, writers that Gerhard Frey recruited to write for his newspaper, namely a fellow named A.J. App, A.P.P., a German-American, whose Federation of American Citizens of German Descent basically lobbied for exactly the same things as the many of the ex-ballet organizations in Germany were lobbying for. This fellow Austin App was also one of the prime generators of the Holocaust revisionist school of history, basically that maintains that the Holocaust never happened. That philosophy or that revisionist history is making a big comeback in the United States through such organizations as the Liberty Lobby. We're going to review Austin next, touching back on the book Blowback by Christopher Simpson. We're going to review Austin App's participation in the campaign by the Assembly of Captive European Nations. This was one of the CIA-financed organizations that became a repository for many of the Galen and Third Reich alumni, and right in there pitching. Along with them is Austin App, the same Austin App who's pitching in the Deutsche Nationalzeitung and Soldatenzeitung. Next, we're going to review some information from the Dallas Conspiracy by Peter Dale Scott. This concerns Edwin Walker's reportage of the Oswald incident, or the alleged incident in which Oswald supposedly fired at him. And we're going to review the Deutsche Nationalzeitung and Soldatenzeitung, and we're going to take a look at the connections between that paper and Dr. Walter Becker and the Wittico League, the ex-ballet organizations, and Theodor Oberlin. They're people that we've spoken about before. Following that, we're going to review some information, also this from government documents in the JFK assassination, concerning the participation of Nelson Bunker Hunt and elements grouped around the Hunt family with a German-based intelligence network that we looked at before, the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, including many people close to the Galen organization, the Adenauer government, and one of the former chairmen of that organization, Theodor Oberlander, an individual, again, who figured profoundly in the history of the Third Reich and in the history of the post-World War II world. We have touched on this information before, but I'm reviewing it so that we can take a look at elements of the American far right functioning in conjunction with Germans who were direct representatives of an unreconstructed German political and national security structure. People like Dr. Walter Becker and Theodor Oberlander, involved with people like Edwin Walker and Nelson Bunker Hunt. These individuals, as we will see this evening, that is to say people like Becker and Oberlander, were unreconstructed Nazis, basically, individuals who were pushing in the post-World War II world for exactly the same goals that Hitler and the Third Reich had been striving for during World War II. And through their hookups, not only with the U.S. National Security Establishment, but also with the American far right, they were able, ultimately, to realize the goals of the Third Reich vis-a-vis Eastern Europe and the European continent in general. And as we will begin to look at this evening and swing back to next week, they also, to a large extent, in conjunction with, and by operating in conjunction with powerful American political forces, they were able ultimately to effect the triumph of their political system over what had been our political system. Next, and by the way, if I run over this evening, if we're not able to get this all in between now and midnight, we will get anything in that I've not been able to include this evening. This will be included next week. We're going to review some information concerning Dr. Gustav A. Sonnenol, an Adenauer official, a former SS officer. This fellow became the head of the Information Office for Marshall Plan Aid under Adenauer, and we're going to take a look at his advocacy of a German policy that would prevent any possibility of a reconciliation between the United States and the former Soviet Union, some of the steps that Presidents Eisenhower and Kennedy had been working toward would have done that, and by way of taking a look at German views, or the views of the quote new unquote German political structure as early as the early 50s, that basically the Cold War could be used to Germany's advantage. Again, bear in mind the principle of anti-communism as a vehicle for conquest. Following that, we're going to review some information concerning the organizations such as the OUNB, the Romanian Iron Guard, the Ustashi of Yugoslavia. These were organizations that worked for Galen during World War II and with Galen as well as with the SS. They ultimately were projected into American political society, evolving as far as the Republican Heritage Groups Council, as we looked at in past broadcasts, Many of these same elements are still there. Ultimately, they were projected back into Eastern Europe in the form of organizations like the Free Congress Foundation and the interrelated anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. And we're going to take a look, again, at reviewing some information about the Free Congress Foundation. We're going to take a look not only at its connections to the OUN group, the Bandera people, but also at the very close connections between Paul Weyrich, head of the Free Congress Foundation and the founder of the Heritage Foundation. We're going to take a look at his connections with Franz Josef Strauss, the individual who presided over and worked on behalf of the resurrected German General Staff and German, from World War II, the resurrected National Security Establishment of the Third Reich. Following that, we're going to take a look at some information concerning the Christian West concept. Again, now what we're going to be doing is swinging back over to this side of the Atlantic. We have taken a look in past broadcasts and we'll review and place in greater depth this evening how the adoption of the Galen organization, a Trojan horse, eventually resulted in the U.S. National Security Establishment and political structure pursuing policies which benefited Germany, policies which had been envisioned by people like Galen and von Dönitz before the end of World War II. We've taken a look at the reconstruction of the map of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union along the lines desired by Alfred Rosenberg's Ostministerium during World War II. What we're going to begin doing now, and we're going to continue this next week as we evolve right up to the present and resume with the unpleasant present, so to speak, we're going to take a look at what happens on this side of the Atlantic, and perhaps the single most important result of the United States having lost the Second World War. And again, I'm not talking about a military defeat, obviously, not a defeat on the battlefield, but rather a political and a consequent economic defeat. And the most profound results of that concerns the corruption of our political system and our society along lines that were desired by the Third Reich, which projected a conquest of the United States. And it should be borne in mind, as you hear the events that I'm going to be running through this evening, that fascism was in no way something which was foreign to the United States. Very powerful people and interests within this country, notably industrialists and financiers, were ardently pro-fascist. Not all of them, obviously, but many of the most powerful were pro-fascist. And with the large number of fascist organizations in this country prior to and during World War II, and with the ardent sympathies of many of our top industrial and corporate interests being pro-fascist, the path was laid, the foundation was laid for the United States turning fascist, and one of the central points in this broadcast of RFA 37, this massive archive show, and something that I will develop more fully next week as we move right back into the present, is that ultimately the Cold War and the pressures that were brought to bear both by American interests and by some of the Third Reich alumni such as Galen and some of the people that we're going to be looking at this evening and that we've looked at in past broadcasts, ultimately those pressures corrupted American society in such a way as to turn it pro-fascist. We're going to review the generation of the Christian West concept, not now, from the book The Old Boys by Burton Hirsch. We're going to take a look at a book that we've used in the past called American Swastika by Charles Higham, by way of taking a look at Alan Dulles and just how pro-fascist, how pro-Nazi Alan Dulles really was. Alan Dulles, of course, a key attorney with Sullivan and Cromwell, a major Wall Street foreign policy law firm, along with his brother John Foster. When John Foster Dulles became Secretary of State under Eisenhower, Alan Dulles became Director of the CIA, and we're going to review his negotiations with Prince von Hohenlohe. You will not see the term Christian West in this particular passage by Charles Higham, but it goes into greater detail concerning the anti-Semitic